from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, the White House shared its blueprint for bringing American greenhouse gas emissions down by more than a quarter by 2025. That is a lot in a hurry. Meanwhile, the U.S. has become a huge fossil fuel producer again. Oil and gas, number one in the world. And oil prices, way down. This hour on Point, American energy production in a time of cheap oil, gas, wind, solar, and more, and where we're headed. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you believe we are a bigger oil producer than Saudi Arabia? What should we be in 10 years? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington to look at the new White House energy and emissions blueprint is Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Coral, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be with you.
It's such a fascinating moment in on the energy front. This blueprint that the White House State Department put out yesterday, what, is by 2025 to bring greenhouse gas emissions down by 26% to 28%. That sounds like a huge number in just 10 years. What are the basic elements of how they would do it, Coral?
So the basic elements are a set of EPA regulations on the U.S. energy economy that the president has already been working on for a couple of years. The heart of it, the biggest piece, is a set of regulations on the electricity industry, on power plants. Specifically, those regulations will be finalized this summer, and they will force electric utilities to cut emissions from their power plants, ultimately leading to the shutdown of probably hundreds of coal-fired power plants, which are the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. So it really takes aim at the coal industry, at coal-fired power plants, and pushes a very dramatic transformation in the U.S. electricity sector, if these regulations stand up. If they work the way that the president has envisioned them, then it is absolutely realistic to expect to see emissions decline by that level. Second set of regulations that also need to work as the president envisions are a set of regulations on the car industry, forcing automakers to build high fuel efficiency cars that will get up to 50 miles per gallon fleet average by 2025. So put those two together and you're cutting emissions in a really big way from the electricity sector, cutting emissions in a really big way from cars and transportation, and that number is actually achievable.
Let me ask some simple questions. Leave the politics aside, though they won't stay aside, we know that, but just technically, is it clear that it's technically doable on the power plant front, on the high mileage cars front? Is there a technical challenge, a question mark, or it's doable, we just have to do it?
Huge technical challenges, no question about it.
On which side, the power plant or car, or both?
On both sides. Electric utilities have said that when they look at the regulations and they look at what it demands for a huge shift from shutting down coal and moving to a big expansion of renewable energy, wind, solar, also natural gas, which has about half the carbon emissions of coal, America's electric utilities, by and large, say, we can do that. It is doable. The challenge that they say is the time frame in which the Obama regulations demand that they do it. It's a very, very rapid switch. And they do fear that shutting down so many coal plants, building so much new renewable capacity, having to build a lot of new transmission lines, that there may be a question of reliability. Literally, will the lights stay on as they are racing to complete this transition in such a rapid period of time? And they say that in order to avoid an outcome like that, there are going to need to be big leaps and bounds in technology. If there can be a lot of technology on things like energy storage, cheaper ways of building solar. If there are a lot of advances and breakthroughs in technology while they're making that transition, breakthroughs in energy efficiency and smart grid, that kind of thing, they say they will be able to meet it, but there will be big technology hurdles. And if we don't see those technology breakthroughs, definitely a chance of blackouts, brownouts, reliability problems. So it's a really big lift for the U.S. Power sector. And exactly the same thing with cars. This is a really big, you know, average fuel economy for cars today is, you know, around 30 miles per gallon.
Right.
This is taking that up to a fleet average of 50 miles per gallon. The automakers are working as hard as they can to research, again, battery technology, electric vehicles, things like hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. You know, and the bet is, okay, well, you know, these companies have American know-how and ingenuity, and, you know, the requirement of the demand is going to force them to make these technology breakthroughs. If they can't, then it won't be possible to meet these regulations. So they really require big lifts in technology and you know, in development.
Coral, this is so fascinating. Again, leaving the domestic politics aside, and they won't stay aside. We'll come to them briefly in a moment, but this is part of a global push to try and rein in greenhouse gases and climate change. Big meeting scheduled for Paris in December. Everybody's supposed to put their cards on the table before then about what they're going to do. The U.S. has now done that. Many other big countries have not. Are people looking at, and yet this is important, we're looking at climate change, we see what's happening already. Even these cuts, as big as they seem, some say they are not big enough, but is this plan seen as ultimately pie in the sky or doable, achievable?
Right now, scientists say it is probably not possible for the U.S. to avoid kind of an initial tipping point for some of the kind of point of no return impacts of climate change. Scientists have been saying for a number of years that point of no return will come when the global atmosphere heats up past an average of 2 degrees Celsius. That's 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. It doesn't sound like a lot, but that's the point at which we'll start to see, you know, massive drought, sea level rise, food shortages, much more extreme storms. And even with the rate that we're seeing promises of emissions cuts coming in, the amount of greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere and the rate at which the global economy is producing them, scientists say that part's probably too late. We will almost certainly hit that tipping point, and it's important for countries to start to prepare for that. The thing that's on the table now is not going further, not getting, you know, to far more extreme droughts, far more damaging sea level rise, and that's really the goal of what they're trying to do in Paris. The pledges that are being put forward now, the domestic policies the countries are saying they're going to enact, won't be enough. The idea is that it will be a starting point, and that governments will have to come back every couple of years and continue to find ways to keep ratcheting down emissions to stave off kind of the worst doomsday scenarios.
The EU, Mexico, Norway, Switzerland have all put their cards on the table, their blueprints. Some other big ones have not: China, India, Brazil, Russia. Now the United States has.
I have to correct you on
please,
that.
Yes.
Russia put out their blueprint about half an hour ago.
Oh, okay. We are right up to date. Thank you.
You know, I was really surprised because, you know, they have really been viewed as a wild card in this. Vladimir Putin is on the record as being a skeptic of the science of climate change.
And they have a big investment, as we do now, in fossil fuels.
So I just got this at 9:54 a.m., the UN sent out the press. So just before we got on the phone, the UN sent out the press release. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but really interesting to see that Russia emerging as an early actor in this. Again, don't know what's in the plan yet. It could be a weak plan. They certainly do. You know, their economy is they are absolutely a petrostate. But as you say, a lot of these other, you know, big economies, big emitters, China is now saying that they will put forward a plan in June. Really, really important to see what they're going to say. Are they going to have a serious plan? Is it going to have teeth? Are they going to, is it going to be transparent? Are we going to be able to be sure that they do what they say they're going to do? I think a lot of the success of this whole endeavor depends on how serious China continues to play in this space. India now looking like, and Brazil now looking like they might not put forward plans until summer or fall, maybe as late as October. The longer these big economies wait, the harder it is to get to really start working and getting a serious plan on the table.
We just got a minute, Coral. Of course, the United States plan, President Obama's plan, depends a lot on executive authority. Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky senator, coal country man, calls it job-killing and likely illegal, the Clean Power Plan. As hard as it may be to actually pull it off, what about just getting it through, putting it into action? Is the Congress, Republican-led, likely to block it?
Congress actually doesn't have too much authority to block it, and Mitch McConnell knows that. You know, he has been sort of out front as one of the most vocal and prominent critics of this plan. He does call it a war on coal. He's from a big coal mining state. He's also not wrong. If this plan works, mm-hmm. as the president envisions, it really will sort of freeze and shut down U.S. demand for coal. The big test of this plan that we'll see will be in the courts. This plan relies on the president making aggressive use of an existing law. That's the Clean Air Act. Mm-hmm. He did not try to go back to Congress and get them to pass something. This Republican Congress would certainly reject a climate change, any kind of climate change legislation. So he's using an old law. He's putting forth very aggressive, bold regulations. They're already being challenged in the courts. It's very likely that this will end up going before the Supreme Court. And that's when we'll know for sure if this plan will live or die. If the courts uphold it, then, you know, the states and electric utilities will be required to enact it. If
Coral, we're up against it right there. You are so terrific. We're grateful for your time with us. Coral Davenport with the New York Times. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about American energy production in a time of low oil prices that could go lower still. American oil, gas, wind, solar, nukes, and what the changed oil price landscape means. New plans out from the White House also yesterday call for a cut in greenhouse gas emissions of 26% to 28% by 2025, just 10 years from now. Here's Josh Earnest, the president's press secretary, of course, talking yesterday about that plan, cutting U.S. emissions by a quarter, getting toward a third over the next decade.
The steps that the United States will take to meet our commitments includes the Clean Power Plan, higher efficiency standards on cars and trucks, improved energy efficiency standards for buildings, broader efforts to reduce HFCs and methane emissions. These are gases that have a disproportionate impact on climate change. And the good news is that these steps aren't just good for the environment, they also are good for our economy.
Meanwhile, here Russia called a petrostate. The U.S. has got an awful lot of fossil fuel, oil especially, coming out of the ground, gas as well. Number one globally in liquid form of each of those. At a lecture in New York earlier this month, Ed Morse, global head of commodities research at Citigroup, talked about the problems the oil industry now faces just storing all that oil.
We're running out of storage capacity in the U.S., and we're seeing the indication of U.S. reaching tank tops. It's hard to know where the price goes down, but it does go down.
Reaching tank tops, the most oil in storage in 80 years. Yesterday, talking with CNBC, Peter Boardman, this is managing director of Tradewinds, big investment firm, says he doesn't expect oil prices to rebound quickly.
There was a huge expectation that oil prices would stay low. You know, it's still a very early days. It's hard to see if oil prices will ever recover to $100 a barrel.
We're going to dive in on all of this. I want to look first at oil, and we will turn to alternatives and the implications there, the path ahead. But first, New York. Michael Levy joins us, Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment, Director for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Power Surge, Energy Opportunity in the Battle for America's Future. Michael Levy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
So many questions here. One of the things we heard was that Saudi Arabia which has been dethroned by the United States as the number one producer, I guess, of oil, wanted to knock a lot of those American drillers out of business by letting oil prices go low. Is that happening, Michael?
I don't think we know exactly what Saudi leaders wanted, and I suspect they are as surprised by how much the price has fallen as we are. When you look at the U.S. scene, though, what you've seen is a large pullback in investment in oil production. So a big decline in planned capital spending, a big decline in the number of rigs drilling. But because producers are targeting the rigs they still have operating at the most productive assets for the most part, U.S. oil production hasn't actually fallen in a significant way. Now, that's still a big change from last year where oil production grew by 1.2 million barrels a day. It's a big change from that to essentially be flat, but we aren't going down in any meaningful way yet.
So, I mean, last year it was huge. What, the biggest expansion since 1900?
Right. Last year was the biggest expansion since the year before, and the year before was the biggest expansion since the year before that. So we've been setting records every year. We won't set one this year.
How long can American drillers keep at it at this kind of $40-something dollars a barrel price of oil? We've heard that they're many of them heavily leveraged, carrying a lot of debt. Oil prices go down, but it's not necessarily any cheaper to drill. So where's that head?
So it is getting a little bit cheaper to drill, and that saves some of these players, but not the others. If you ask people in the markets, there seems to be a sense that there will be a reckoning sometime in the second half of this year as some companies run out of money or others have their investors realize that the things they're doing in order to avoid running out of money are extraordinarily counterproductive, drilling when it's not really wise to be doing that. And so then maybe we get something of an adjustment. But for now, it's extraordinary how resilient the sector has been, at least in terms of the amount it's able to produce, if not in terms of the amount of money it's able to make, the amount it's able to actually do profitably.
I'm reading here T. Boone Pickens talking with the Wall Street Journal just a day ago, saying that we've gone from 1,500 rigs to just over 800. That seems like a big downturn. Is production gone down equivalently?
It hasn't gone down equivalently, and there are two basic reasons for that. The first is that something like 80% of the oil that was being produced from these rigs a year ago was coming from 20% of the drilling. So you can cut back a lot on the drilling. If you're focusing on the most productive wells, you're still getting most of the oil that you previously would have. The other thing that we see is that there's a lag between drilling and actual production. So the rigs are telling you, okay, this is how much is being drilled. But once you drill a well, you then have to frack it, you have to bring it online, you have to connect it to the system. And that it typically has taken a couple months in the past. Given the current situation where people expect prices to rise a bit in the future, it's taking even longer. They're sort of, a lot of them are waiting to see if they can bring these wells online when prices go higher. So the impact of this lower rig count is lagged when you look at what it means for production.
So with these prices, do you expect the U.S. to remain the number one oil producer, or is that always a changing ranking?
It's always a changing ranking. It depends on what you mean by oil. I also don't think that it's the most important thing to be looking at. What matters here is not so much the sheer volume, but the pace at which it's emerged from the United States. The market has difficulty adjusting to rapid and unexpected changes. I think that's why you've seen a 50-plus percent drop in global prices based on a roughly 2% excess of global oil production over consumption. That tells you something about how sensitive the global market is to these sorts of mismatches, and it tells you that you should expect prices to whipsaw for the indefinite future.
OPEC came out with a big report just a couple of weeks ago, I'm sure you saw it, saying that the U.S. oil boom could be over by the end of this year, kind of pessimistic view they were putting forward, maybe for competitive reasons, of American producers, quoting here the Wall Street Journal, ability to withstand a historic collapse in crude prices. They said the oil markets are at a crossroads, demonstrating the uncertainty over the staying power of the American oil boom. How do you see the staying power?
certainly not a pessimistic outlook if you are a member of OPEC. I think that if you try to tell a story where oil prices stay low, crush U.S. industry, and somehow that's sustainable, it doesn't make much sense to me. The whole reason we're seeing these very low oil prices is because of these large gains in U.S. production. So either we see higher prices, which incentivizes additional U.S. production, we find a new balance there. Or if you see low prices at some point, that wears off. The U.S. production falls. There's, again, a mismatch between supply and demand in the other direction, and you rebound. But a world in which U.S. production is low and prices are low only exists if the global economy is in deep, deep trouble, because otherwise it's not clear where you get the oil to satisfy global economic demand.
And is fracking, continued hydraulic fracturing, the key to continued high U.S. production? Do we have to push that further and further, or how's that unfolding, Michael?
It certainly is. There are other sources that are contributing to U.S. production. You have offshore drilling that's also contributing, but the big driver behind these gains is this combination of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. It is what has been driving these million barrel a day year-on-year gains over the last several years. It's what will make or break the future gains in production. It's also why some people think that production could fall off substantially. These hydraulically fractured wells, each well, let's say in North Dakota, drops its production 80% in its first year. So if you're not continuing to drill, production can fall off substantially. That's a fundamentally different characteristic from the oil wells we've been used to historically.
Michael Levy with the Council on Foreign Relations, the Director for Geoeconomic Studies there. Please stand by in New York. I want to turn to Stanford, California, and Jeff Ball, scholar in residence at Stanford University's Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance. Jeff, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So here we've got oil flowing in the United States like at a rapidly increasing clip again last year. The biggest expansion since the year 1900, U.S. number one in oil production now. It may not be all that important as a ranking. I mean, I know it's Final Four time, but even so. But it's, I think, amazing to people to hear that we're bigger than Saudi Arabia. What does all this mean for alternative energy, Jeff? The last time oil prices cratered, go back to the late 80s, into the 90s, we went into SUVs and I think a kind of stagnant time for a lot of alternative energy. What about this time?
You're right. That historically, interest in alternatives to fossil fuels has tracked the rise and fall of fossil fuel prices, particularly oil prices, pretty closely. And so in the early 1970s, when the oil embargo in the Middle East caused oil prices to shoot up in Europe and the United States, there was a huge upsurge in interest in alternatives, things like solar and wind and alternative transportation fuels. And that all pretty much cratered in the early 1980s when oil prices fell back down. There are a couple of indications that that is indeed happening at the margins now. If you look at auto sales numbers, for instance, in the early part of this year, the first couple months of this year, the sales of large SUVs were up almost 60% over the same period last year. The sales of Teslas, the expensive electric cars, were down almost 30% compared to the same 2 months last year. So if you look at Americans' driving preferences, cheap oil, cheap gasoline at the pump causes people to change their supposedly more efficient ways that they achieved over the past 5 or 10 years. However, I think some things are importantly different between now and 30 or 40 years ago, and I think that suggests that the gains that a number of alternative energy sources have made, really pretty striking gains over the last 5 or 10 years, are likely not to be significantly displaced by the reduction in oil prices. And let me just mention a couple of things.
Yes.
It's important to mention for people to understand first that oil today, unlike in the 1970s, is almost exclusively a transportation fuel.
Yeah.
There was a time 40 years ago when a lot of the world burned a lot of oil to produce electricity. And therefore, a rise or fall in oil prices would have a direct effect on your wanting to say, get solar or wind to produce electricity as an antidote. That's not the case today. So today, when oil prices go up or down, the effect on electricity prices is very muted, except to the extent that natural gas and oil prices are linked. Natural gas is a fuel for electricity.
Yep.
So So given that the transportation and electricity fuels are separate, the real question is what happens to prices, how prices affect, say, how electricity prices affect demand for solar and wind. And solar and wind have come down quite markedly in their cost over the last 5 or 10 years. And I think that it's likely that the oil price fall is not likely to affect that much. Here's one way it might affect it. In popular parlance, in political parlance, what people care about when they think about energy is how much they pay for gasoline. When people are paying a lot for gasoline, they tend to be very concerned about the price of energy broadly, and therefore politicians are likelier to support incentives for alternatives because in the popular parlance, shifting away from fossil fuels is a good thing. When oil prices are low, there's likely to be much less political support for incentives for renewable energy like solar and wind, and I suspect that you will see that. There are a couple important incentives for solar and wind that have just ended or are about to end. And I suspect that given low oil prices, there's going to be less support for renewing those things than would have been the case otherwise. However, solar and wind really have come down a lot in their prices, and I think that those gains are likely to stay, even though those sources of energy are quite low as a portion of the total energy pie.
SUV sales up 60%, you cite Tesla sales down, and you can kind of hear the unease maybe. Founder Elon Musk saying just in the last week, quoted saying, burning fossil fuels is the dumbest experiment in history by far. We're talking about American energy production in a time of low oil prices. Jeff Ball in Stanford, California, if the Obama administration's blueprint for cutting carbon emissions in the U.S. by 26-28% by 2025 goes forward, big piece of that is taking coal-fired power plant production way down. How much of that will be supplanted then by alternative energy sources, or how much is just natural gas?
Well, it's really interesting to note that even before the Obama administration said anything about a promise of a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, U.S. greenhouse gas emissions had fallen quite significantly, and that's almost exclusively due to natural gas having supplanted coal to a large extent as an electricity fuel. So we were on this track already. It's also interesting to note that according to government estimates, if the U.S. does proceed with the kinds of promises the Obama administration has made on carbon reductions, that would amount to all of about a 1% reduction in annual global greenhouse gas emissions, which is not to minimize the significance of a U.S. plan. The U.S. is a huge energy consumer and carbon emitter, but it is to return to a point that you've made earlier on this program, which is that China is hugely important. Developing countries are hugely important. And so the U.S. is mostly important for what it goads other countries into doing. Now, as for renewables, the portion of electricity coming from renewables has increased at double-digit rates over the past several years, each of the past several years. But those bases were incredibly low.
Yes.
So solar and wind are still collectively providing only a couple percentage points of the nation's electricity. I think there are quite ambitious projections that that will increase. And I suspect that those projections are right. But there's huge disagreement about the extent of the total pie that will come from those sources. And a lot of the answer to that is going to have to do, number one, with what happens to natural gas prices more than oil prices, and number two, to what extent the cost of producing solar and wind can continue to come down at the rate that it's come down over the last 5 or 10 years, a rate that's been pretty extraordinary.
Do you have a sense if we hit those targets that the White House is laying out yesterday, 26-28% less greenhouse emissions, how much growth might there be in renewables during that same period, backing that up?
Well, I don't think anyone knows the exact numbers. There are very, very ambitious numbers. And what's been interesting is that fairly middle-of-the-road analysts over the last year have been coming out with increasingly bullish numbers about the extent, particularly of energy, that particularly that solar can provide. I mean, I think it's absolutely clear that these sources are going to provide a lot more energy. I think it's also clear that 20 years down the road, fossil fuel is still going to be the dominant source of electricity in this country and in the world. So people who suggest that renewables are going to supplant fossil fuels, I think, are probably being overly rosy. But by the same token, people who suggest that solar and wind are just sort of dalliances, which might have been the case 30 years ago, are clearly wrong as well.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American energy production in a time of low oil prices that could go lower still. American oil, gas, wind, solar, nukes, and what the changed oil price landscape means. Michael Levy is with us from the Council on Foreign Relations, director of the Geoeconomic Studies Program there, joins us from New York. Jeff Ball in Stanford, California, scholar in residence at Stanford's Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance. Michael, Jeff, lots of callers for you. Nancy in New York, North Rose, New York. Nancy, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Hi. This is a huge subject, and there are a number of points, two points that I was going to ask about. Number one would be how exactly these emissions are measured, because if the gas and oil drilling industry is exempt from the clean air and clean water regulations, then they don't have to be measured. And we know that they're contributing to a high level of emissions at the production site.
At the wellhead, yeah.
At the wellhead. And why are we even talking about the gas and oil prices now when if the U.S. is a major producer, we're basically creating the emissions. We should be counting the emissions at production, or at the origin of production, because if we're creating a product, it's going to be burned and will be emitting somewhere, even if it's not in our country.
Yeah.
And so that's my argument. We're talking out of both sides of our mouths when we're saying on one hand that we're going to cut emissions, on the other hand that we're opening up new ground for oil development.
Nancy, let us pick it up right there, and I appreciate your call very much. I mean, Neil is also writing us online. Jeff, I'll put this one to you. Neil is similar, says natural gas, Neil asserts, does not have half the greenhouse gas emissions of coal. That ignores, he says, the leakage from the ground and at the wellhead and elsewhere through the system. He says the carbon footprint of natural gas is possibly nearly as bad as coal. What do you say to that, Jeff Ball?
Yeah, let me make two quick points. Number one, we're talking about climate change in this discussion on the assumption that countries that are making climate pledges, the U.S., China, others, yeah, are doing so primarily because they're concerned about climate change. And that might be a sensible assumption, but I think it's probably not the right assumption.
Explain.
I think the reality is that countries like the U.S. and China and others are making carbon reduction pledges that have the effect of reducing carbon emissions to the extent that those reductions are in line with other priorities that these countries have that they regard as more important. So in the United States, many of these programs, part of the U.S. pledges, were instituted at a time of high oil prices. I think it's fair to say that most of these were an attempt to shift off of oil for cars or to improve the efficiency of oil for cars to reduce coal emissions, the kind of stuff that makes you cough. Similarly in China, which has really bad air pollution problems, as many of your listeners
know. So it was for economy and health. health, not for exactly. CO2 emissions and control.
Precisely, and there are absolutely ancillary climate benefits to that, but I think people want to sort of keep their eye on the right ball, and the ball is those things like the economy and health, things that are much more palpable to most people.
I mean, you can call that the right ball, but I'm not sure who gets to judge what the right ball is. A lot of our listeners are very concerned about climate change, and I'm not
making a value judgment. I'm just saying that I think that that's probably first in line in the minds of the people who are making the policy.
Could you speak to the science behind the wellhead leakage and whether its overall emissions are equivalent to that as coal?
There are huge questions about this. As you've noted, the assumption is that natural gas, pound for pound, emits about half the CO2 emissions as coal. There are big questions, however, about emissions that are produced at the wellhead and leakage along the way in the pipelines. I don't think there's agreement about that. There are quite dueling studies about this. There's absolutely going to be much more work on this, and it's a huge, huge issue that's become at the top of the political agenda.
Michael, are we in la-la land if we don't measure those emissions when we're talking about climate change?
We need to improve our measurement of those emissions, but let's keep a couple things straight. Mm-hmm. First, the bulk of greenhouse gas emissions come when the fuel is burned, and that ought to be our prime focus. For natural gas, when natural gas is burned instead of coal, we incur far lower emissions. When we add to the global oil supply, on the other hand, we are adding to global emissions. And there the big question is, how much do we actually add to the total, and how much are we just replacing other sources? When we focus sharply on the methane piece, I think it's worth separating this into two. Methane is a problem. If we can cost-effectively reduce methane emissions, we get climate benefits and even economic ones. But we aren't looking at a range of uncertainty that could make gas worse for climate change than coal. I think there is actually a pretty broad consensus, not universal, there are outliers, but pretty broad consensus that for the range of possible plausible methane leaks, gas remains better for climate change than coal, plus very good from a host of other local air pollution metrics.
Michael, while we're on that, may I just ask you, and Nancy alluded to this, but I know there's been a big push by oil company CEOs recently to lift the American ban on exports of oil. Now, we get that our production adds to global oil supply and emissions, I guess, whether it's exported or not. But what about that push? How would are they politically lining up? Might they get that export ban lifted? And what would the implications of that be?
So I think the export ban is mostly an issue for U.S. oil producers and for U.S. refiners who are currently benefiting from having oil trapped in the United States that they can buy at a lower price. I wouldn't put it high on the climate agenda, but I assume that at some point in the future, the U.S. ban will be substantially relaxed. The question is how and when, rather than whether it will happen. Right now, we're exporting plenty of oil. We're just turning it into gasoline and diesel fuel first before we ship it abroad. And I imagine that at some point, some of the oil we export will be straight crude oil.
Let's go to Stillwater, Oklahoma, and Bill. Bill, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Tom. I'm concerned about dismantling coal-fired plants in the immediate future because that's going to make us really dependent on natural gas. We're already going with more natural gas-fired or cars, city buses, cargo ships even. And I think money would be better spent trying to find ways to clean up coal so that we can use it still as an alternative, move away from it, but have it as a resource. Then we could even sell that technology to China, which would help more for global, cleaning up the atmosphere globally.
Bill, it's a very interesting question. Jeff Bell, may I bring that to you? What about economically and in terms of actually cleaning it up? How do you see the real prospects for coal? Could you have clean coal that was so clean that it wasn't a carbon emissions killer? And what about the economics of cleaning it?
Well, virtually everyone who looks at the global balance of emissions concludes that it is virtually impossible to meet the kind of climate carbon reduction goals that organizations have laid out internationally without cleaning up the burning of coal. And that's largely
you mean stopping it or cleaning it?
Reducing, sorry?
Do you mean stopping the burning, or could you clean it to produce?
No, cleaning up the burning. Because the assumption is that even to the extent that the U.S. reduces its consumption of coal is surging in places like China and India, outpacing the reduction of the consumption of coal in the United States. So we ought to keep a global view here. And this is not me speaking. This is experts at various international organizations who have concluded that, therefore, it's really important to figure out how to clean up coal. Now, will it happen? There's a lot of money, billions of dollars, going in internationally into what's colloquially called clean coal, a term that is hugely controversial itself.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say that progress has been a lot slower than people thought. There are really interesting experiments going on in China as well as in the United States. It's starting to scale up a bit, but it's fair to say that it is nowhere near viable commercially at the scale that will make much of an environmental difference. But it's absolutely important, not because one likes or dislikes coal, but because the vast majority of predictions suggest that, like it or not, the world is going to continue to burn a lot of coal. And by the way, to the extent that the U.S. is reducing its consumption of coal at home, U.S. exports of coal to developing countries like China and India are increasing. So one should not assume that just because Washington says we're going to crack down on coal-fired power plants in the U.S., that coal is not going to be burned. And from the climate's perspective, whether coal is burned in Beijing or Boston, it still has the same effect on the climate.
So, Michael, from that perspective, then, does it make for the U.S., does it make more sense to clean it up, try and go to clean coal, or to close it down, just shutter those coal plants?
In the next 10 years, which is the time frame that the regulations are focused on right now, we don't have the technology at a reasonable cost to clean the carbon dioxide out of coal. And that means that we are going to be focused on shifting to other sources. I disagree with what Coral said about needing storage breakthroughs and all sorts of other fancy things in order to get to these goals. I think that natural gas efficiency and renewables as we know them should be able to get us there. I also think that we can overplay this story about leakage from coal production. Yes, there will be more coal exports if we use less coal at home. But if you look at the numbers, those coal exports are not anywhere close to large enough to offset the climate benefits that we're getting by using less coal at home.
We've got Roy in Boise writing to us here, says high voltage DC transmission lines, lithium ion batteries for homes and businesses, more hybrid electric vehicles are all on the way. Cheap oil, Roy writes, may slow the transition, but the process is underway and inevitable. Well, Richard in New York, Liverpool, New York. Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Yes.
I think the real subject is this whole global issue, including all the technical issues, the technological, business, political, sociological issues. It's really a huge global intelligence test. I, as a pretty intelligent guy, for example, I make my own biodiesel. I run a 30-year-old Mercedes, and I have a net gain of like zero carbon when I drive down the road.
Yep.
People look at me with their Priuses and cars, and they're basically driving a coal-powered car. 40% of their electrical energy in a plug-in car is coal. So we basically, I feel as a citizen, and I hope I represent the feelings of most of the audience, is that I'm getting on an airplane driven by a suicidal pilot. I feel that our politicians, our businesses are not owning up to the fact that we're trying to burn 400 million years of carbon in a couple of hundred years. That's a ratio of 1 to like 2 million.
Yeah.
And the intelligence test is, doesn't anybody see that every particular interest group, you know, the energy lobbies, political concerns, and, you know, every country that has cheap fuel will become a very rich and very powerful country. So
Richard, we've got a global intelligence test here right in front of us. We're looking at American energy production. Of course, its implications are global. Jeff Ball, how about it? I mean, Richard looks at our policy overall and says it's like getting on a plane driven by a suicidal pilot because, big picture, our leaders are not taking us at a rapid pace away from the climate change mountainside. What do you say, Jeff?
Well, there are lots of efforts going on to shift this supertanker. I think one thing that people need to realize is that the energy system globally is absolutely massive, mind-bogglingly massive, and it doesn't shift easily. There are pretty significant shifts going on now. A surge, as we've discussed, in renewables off, albeit a small base, but quite significant and likely to be much bigger in the future. And a shift, at least in the United States, as we've discussed, from coal to natural gas, which in terms of burning it is a cleaner fuel. So I think to conclude that because we're still emitting a lot of carbon and massively reliant on fossil fuels, we will always be that way is just sort of using current the situation as the future, and I think no one can predict it. I would just say one other thing, that in terms of electric cars burning coal and therefore being not good for the environment, there's a really different picture across this country. So if I drive an electric car in the Midwest, I'm emitting a lot more than if I drive an electric car in California.
You need more coal-fired energy in the Midwest.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That's right. So it's a very complicated picture, but again, I think it's fair to say that there are sort of a number of shoots happening on this field of energy that are quite significant, and that we're engaged in a pretty significant transition. And the debate is about how far that transition goes.
I'm looking here at headlines just in the last few days. France requiring that new buildings green their roofs. On the rooftop, it has to be either solar panels or plants. China raising its solar target for 2015, adding 2.5 times as much capacity as the U.S. added last year. Michael Levy, overall, do the new fossil fuel outputs that we're seeing in this country speed us toward fixing the problem or avoiding it?
I think it depends entirely on which piece of the fossil fuel output you're looking at. The boom in natural gas production has made it possible to put these EPA regulations on power plants in place. They would have been unthinkable 5 years ago. They are plausible because we can see gas as a replacement for coal. On the oil side, I think the big risk is something that Jeff pointed to. It's not the risk that this will crush the markets directly for alternatives. It's the risk that policymakers will decide that they no longer need to push on fuel economy standards, that they no longer need to push on next generation vehicles, that they relax and that the market for alternatives falls apart because of that.
Well, we've learned a lot in this hour. The president's plan putting us on a fast track to a pretty big reduction, 26-28% by 2025. That's just 10 years. That will be amazing to watch. Of course, the political fireworks around that will be right in front of us, the war on coal talk and all the rest. But as you say, Jeff Ball, also real advances being made in alternative energy, real opportunities to change here. Jeff Ball at the Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy, joining us today from Stanford, California. Jeff, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
And Michael Levy, author of The Power Surge and By All Means Necessary, Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment, Director for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, joining us from New York. Michael, thank you very much for your insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.